It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talked to one of the scientists who reported yesterday that the West Antarctic ice sheet is rapidly disintegrating, due in part to global warming. We check on how the Affordable Care Act affects long-term care for HIV-positive Wisconsinites.
First, when the faulty practices of mortgage companies and big banks were revealed as a cause behind the 2008 financial crisis, the American public and many politicians wanted justice.
Today, our guest writes, almost 6 years later, only one Wall Street executive has been put behind bars. Instead of criminal prosecutions for the executives of mortgage companies and banks, the Department of Justice has widely pursued cash settlements, a big change from legal consequences following past busts in the economy.
Our guest says those settlements have now come to be seen as part of doing business for big companies.
Jesse Eisinger is with us. He's senior reporter at ProPublica, covering Wall Street and finance. He writes a regular column for the New York Times deal book section. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, as we said, almost 6 years after the 2008 financial crisis, a lot of talk about borderline illegal mortgage and banking practices, some clearly illegal ones, only one executive doing time. Tell us about that one executive.
Well, his name is Kareem Sarageldin, not exactly a household name. He was an executive at Credit Suisse, the Swiss investment bank and bank, and he oversaw traders who traded complex mortgage securities. And he was about four levels from the CEO. And being such, he was the highest ranking executive on Wall Street to go to prison for crimes related to the financial crisis, which is a fairly shocking state of affairs.
He's a fairly small fish in the scope of things.
I think he's quite a small fish. I don't think that most people would understand this to be justice. Either many people would go to prison for actions related to the financial crisis, or no one. One person, although he is guilty, just doesn't strike people viscerally as something that's just.
In past crises, have we seen more criminal prosecution, more bank executives in jail?
10 years ago, of course, we had the terrible scandals surrounding the accounting misdeeds of major American companies, Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia, Tyco. Those executives, top executives, went to prison. So we had the capacity then to put people in prison for complex and difficult, arcane crimes. In the savings and loan crisis of the late 1980s, early 1990s, we charged over 1,000 people and convicted 800. Many of those were the top bankers, top executives. So we have in the past seen booms and then busts and then criminal prosecutions related to those booms and busts.
So the bulk of your reporting that we're talking about examines the question of why that has changed. One of the things you point toward is a reliance more on pursuing financial settlements, payments, instead of seeking jail time for culpable executives. What led to that change?
Well, it's been a long time coming. The Department of Justice initially used to charge individuals. And then throughout the 80s and 1990s, they started to realize that you couldn't root out corruption at a corporation and entity by just going after individuals, because you could slot in a honest CFO to a corrupt organization and the organization would corrupt the individual. And so it seemed that you had to go after corporations as well, and they sort of shifted to do that as well. And that all came undone in the Arthur Anderson conviction, which was a real debacle for the Department of Justice, at least perceived as such. Arthur Anderson was Enron's accountant and destroyed documents relating to the investigation. They were convicted by a jury, and then Arthur Anderson went out of business, putting tens of thousands of people on the street unemployed. And then eventually it was overturned, the conviction, by the Supreme Court. the Department of Justice turned away from focusing on convictions for major corporations because of that. It became much more difficult for them to do that. And in lieu of those convictions, they started to focus on deferred prosecution settlements and these agreements where the company promises not to behave badly in exchange for money and sometimes some kind of monitoring. This hasn't proven very effective in rooting out corporate corruption, I don't think.
You, along with your reporting, share some response from the Department of Justice, fairly extensive response to your questions. They make the case, among other things, that, hey, these financial settlements are real punishment, a real disincentive against future bad behavior. They point toward, I think it was a $9 billion settlement with J.P. Morgan. Isn't that maybe just as effective as saying, hey, a couple of executives are going to end up serving jail time?
I don't think most prosecutors I've spoken to don't think, most defense lawyers don't think that the kinds of fines that they're talking about, even though they're astronomical, provide the kind of deterrence that sending a chief executive or CFO to prison would have. So no, I don't think that that's right. I mean, there are a couple of problems with the settlements. One is that even though they seem very big, it turns out that they're fractions of corporations' assets or profits. So we're really not hitting them where it hurts. We're not touching the executives' own compensation. And then the second problem is that they're paid by shareholders. And shareholders are, in some ways, you can think of them as victims of the corporate corruption, not as perpetrators of it. I don't mind hitting shareholders. I think that teaches shareholders some kinds of lessons, but it doesn't teach shareholders or executives the kind of potent lesson that prison for individuals would teach.
And are executives developing a mentality where those fines are just part of the cost of doing business? The possible rewards for misbehavior outweigh the potential costs?
I think that if you're a rational Wall Street executive, you look around and you say, my colleagues and maybe I helped blow up the world economy. We helped bring about the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. We got paid very well to do it, to take a lot of risk. And then none of my peers went to prison. And in fact, we didn't really lose that much money in the end. We got where our pay is back to where it was. Our bank accounts weren't really hit. And we paid very little social costs. We still get to go to the galas at the Met or the Robin Hood Foundation benefit. That's a nice risk reward. You probably were going to do it again.
You mentioned the Arthur Andersen case, and one of the lessons that you say seems to have been learned is that we don't want to pursue big businesses, possibly drive them out of business and put the economy at risk. How big is the too big to fail factor when it comes to prosecutors, federal prosecutors of the Department of Justice deciding to pursue executives or an entire corporation?
I think this is quite significant. They have become very afraid of charging certain kinds of major corporations that rely on government business or rely on charters granted by the government because they're worried about these collateral consequences. And look, I think that is a valid concern. I do have some sympathy for the tens of thousands employees at Arthur Andersen. Of course, many of them were able to find a job, but the ones who weren't able to find a job were the most innocent of them, the secretaries and janitors and things like that. They had it toughest. But I don't think that's the proper role for the Department of Justice to focus on. And sometimes the cost of not bringing justice to a corporation by not bringing charges has greater harm for society than bringing it and having people harmed, individuals harmed, because of the economic fallout from it. So I think this is not the proper thing for the department to be focused on, to the exclusion of bringing criminals to justice.
You also argue that some of the crimes or alleged crimes that are committed leading up to that crash in 2008 are subtle, maybe hard to prove before a jury. Prosecutors might prefer something like insider trading that's more easily explained. Are these too complicated to pursue sometimes?
Yeah, they are extremely complicated. I don't think that that's an excuse, a proper excuse. I mean, a lot of people's jobs are hard, prosecutors' jobs can be hard too, but that doesn't mean that they get a pass on their failures. One argument would be that there weren't crimes committed in the lead up to the financial crisis or during the financial crisis. I think that strains most sentient human beings' credulity. And so given that there was only one person in prison, then we have to think that there was some kind of failure to execute here. And I think the failures are myriad. They've lost a lot of tools. They were resource constrained. The culture has been marked by sort of fear, trepidation, caution, overweening caution, really. In particular, the Southern District of New York and the U.S. Attorney's Office of Manhattan has focused on insider trading, which is an easier charge to bring. And they've had this fantastic run. There were something like 80 for 80 in trials and charges brought. And then they like to win, and they're afraid of losing. And so this provided a wonderful opportunity for them to get on the front page of the Wall Street Journal and win a lot of cases. And unfortunately, that meant that they took their eye off the ball of something that was vastly more important, which was holding people accountable for crimes, I believe, related to the financial crisis.
We're talking to Jesse Eisinger. He's a senior reporter at ProPublica. He recently published a report on the culture of what he calls corporate impunity in the years since the 2008 financial crisis. And we'd like to hear from you. It's been 6 years since that crisis. He says one high-level Wall Street executive has been imprisoned, and he wasn't at the top echelons. Do you think big corporations feel immune to the law? Do you think it's better to fine corporations or put executives in jail? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're back with Jesse Eisinger. He's senior reporter at ProPublica. He recently published a report on a culture of corporate impunity in the years since the 2008 financial crisis. He says prosecutors aren't seeking criminal convictions of executives. Only one executive of note is in jail because of the 2008 financial crisis. And we want to hear from you with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you wish the federal government, federal prosecutors had been more aggressive against Wall Street banks, mortgage companies after that crash? 800-642-1234. Or do you think chasing cash settlements instead of seeking jail time for executives is a good way to go? You can also post, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. Jesse, I want to get a look at who is enforcing these laws, who's making the decision on these prosecutions. Who are the players here?
Well, it's the Department of Justice, which is a funny sort of entity. There's the office in D.C., the Main Justice is the nickname, and that's run by Eric Holder, who oversees the whole network. But then there are individual U.S. attorney's offices around the country, and each U.S. attorney is pretty autonomous and doesn't exactly answer to the Department of Justice in Washington. And then there's a head of the criminal division within Main Justice. His name was Lanny Brewer for most of the Obama administration, and he was in charge of some individual investigations in the financial crisis, related to the financial crisis, but not many. He became the face of the Department of Justice's failures, but in fact, it wasn't really his responsibility. And the responsibility was diffused over all these offices. So the Los Angeles office investigated Countrywide, the mortgage bank, and the Seattle office investigated Washington Mutual, and three offices in New Jersey and New York investigated Lehman Brothers, and so on and so forth. And the diffusion of resources and the disbursement of investigations really hindered them, in my view, because there was so little coordination and so little planning. And similar cases could have been made against similar institutions, as we're seeing in civil cases. But because there was such diffusion, that didn't happen.
Was there talk of a task force or more cooperation that might have helped streamline that?
There was. The Bush administration, which was outgoing when the financial crisis hit, made the initial decision not to do a task force. And the irony was that they sort of took the lessons from the Enron task force and decided against a national task force. The Enron task force, in popular opinion, was pretty successful because they got Jeff Skilling, they got Ken Lay, who died before going to prison but was found guilty. They got the top officers of Enron. But internally in the Justice Department, they took a different lesson, which was they learned that, or they believed that task forces were bureaucratic nightmares and slow acting, and they were overly aggressive and got reversed on a lot of charges, including the Skilling sentence. And so they shied away from that. So the Bush administration made the early decision not to go for a task force. And then it was revisited in the Obama administration in the first year. But the Obama administration was completely caught up with petty political battles and a lot of wrangling for position. And because of that, the task force sort of fell victim to that. And they ended up in the first year at the very end coming up with a press release task force, essentially, policy by press release, that kind of giant, slow-moving, bureaucratic financial task force that didn't do much of anything except hold a lot of useless meetings.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Maria on the line in Toma. Maria, hi.
Hi. Excuse me. I'm just wondering, does anybody have any idea how many people could have potentially gone to prison?
You know, that's not a possible number to have. I mean, I think that there were potential criminal cases to be had with Lehman Brothers, AIG, Countrywide, possibly Bear Stearns, maybe even Goldman Sachs and their CDO business. But the number of cases, there's no definitive number sitting of criminal people out there wandering around.
Potentially more than one, though.
I believe so. Most people believe so. But the problem is, if you don't look, you're not going to find them.
Donna called, couldn't stay on the line. She wants to know, when corporations pay these fines, where does the money go?
The money goes to a variety of places. It'll go to restitution to victims sometimes. It will go into the Treasury. It'll go into state AGs if state AGs are attorneys general if they're involved. So it generally sort of finds its way back into, for taxpayers.
I wanted to talk to you about the regulators and the prosecutors. Are they insulated enough, do you think, from political pressure, whether criticism from Congress or within the administrative branch? Do they need more independence?
That's a good question. The U.S. attorneys are already pretty independent and autonomous. I think that the bigger issue is that they that there's a terrible revolving door where U.S. attorneys are generally young, and they go there for build their resumes, and they don't want to be lifers. In fact, the lifers, lifetime federal prosecutors, are looked down upon within the organization, and so you're either going to move up and then out to a white shoe firm, or you move up politically, and so you have a lot of political ambitions. The moving up to a white shoe firm means that what you want to do is get a lot of wins, so you'll take on relatively easy small cases, and then you can become a partner at a major firm and make literally 10 times what you were making as a federal prosecutor. You start in at $1.5 million as a prosecutor, as a partner at a major firm like Covington and Burling, and then You have a maid. That's a nice salary. So what you want to do is not be overly aggressive, not ruffle too many feathers, get the kind of win that makes people admire you, but hasn't really infuriated anybody or broken any unwritten rules.
Just briefly, are there any calls, any action toward reform of how this all works?
Not yet. I mean, the Department of Justice has been stung with the charge that it considers these banks too big to jail. And so what they're trying to do now is bring criminal charges against banks. And they're starting with trying to bring criminal charges against two foreign banks, Credit Suisse and BNP Paribas. They haven't successfully brought them yet, but they're, the reports are that they're trying to. So they have taken that to heart, and they want to bring criminal charges. But the meaningfulness of a criminal charge, if they go bend over backwards to make it so that the criminal charge has very little impact on the business, is in question. In other words, if what they're doing is they're going around to regulators and saying, well, if we charge this bank, are you going to take away their charter? And
we'll have to leave it there. Jesse, thanks for joining us. We've been speaking with Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter at ProPublica, talking about his piece on corporate impunity in the years since the 2008 financial crisis.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we look at how the Affordable Care Act is affecting HIV-positive people here in Wisconsin.
But first, two groups of scientists reported yesterday that a large part of the ice sheet that covers the West Antarctic is rapidly melting due to global warming.
These reports have jolted the scientific community, who fear that this could lead to a significant rise in sea levels sooner than previously expected.
A scientist on one of the teams is with us now to share the findings. Eric Rignot is professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine, and a glaciologist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, Eric, you're part of one of the teams that discovered this rapid melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet. What did you find?
Well, maybe the word discovered is a little bit too strong. We've known about the evolution of ice in this sector of Antarctica for quite a while. Probably the last 20 years, we've been keeping a close eye to this part of Antarctica. It's more like we reached the point where we collected enough observations and multiple lines of evidence, and especially along the lines of mapping the bed beneath the ice sheets, to reach our conclusion that the retreat of ice in that sector was unstoppable.
As I understand it, this is an ice sheet that is sort of in the form of a bowl, and that there is water underneath it that's contributing to the retreat of the ice. Is that how you describe it?
It's in the form of the bowl because the ice depresses the crust beneath it. So as you move farther inland, the ice getting thicker and the bed is at lower elevation. The base of the glaciers are all below sea level, so that big piece of ice wants to become afloat into the ocean. But there's no water underneath that ice sheet. It's just at the periphery, right? These glaciers flow into the ocean, and they develop these floating extensions that interact vigorously with the ocean.
And so how did these two teams, your team included, come to the conclusion that what is happening now with this ice sheet in Antarctica is unstoppable, that it will be retreating and it's going to lead to rising sea levels?
The reason we reached that is that we have long-term observations of the evolution of the glacier velocity, all the glaciers in this area. We've seen all the glaciers in that sector respawn, accelerate, thin, and retreat at the same time, which suggests the common cause for the forcing, which is the ocean. We've seen the retreat of the grounding line, the place where they meet with the ocean and become afloat. And one of the important pieces also is that we gathered a lot of information on the topography of the bed beneath the ice sheet. This was done over many years of surveys by aircraft, combined with some other data to reveal high-resolution details to sort of unravel if there were any pieces of the bed topography that could slow down the retreat of these glaciers towards the interior. And we reached the point where we think that there's no such thing, no such big mountain that could halt their retreat.
Now, scientists, as a general rule, don't tend to be hysterical about things. They don't tend to be overly dramatic or use hyperbole. And yet, a lot of the quotes that I've seen about this, it's clear that this has sort of shaken those in the community who study glaciers. How big a deal is this?
I think among the community of glaciologists, it's probably not a big surprise to make this statement. You know, the concept of the instability of this part of Antarctica was brought forward by brilliant scientists back in the 70s, Terry Hughes and Bob Thomas and others. At the time, there was no observations to confirm whether these projections were right or not. We had to wait until the 1990s to really get some good observations of this part of Antarctica. It's one of the most remote parts of Antarctica.
And as I understand it, some of those who put forth the theory that this this part of the glacier was vulnerable back in the 80s, those scientists were sort of harassed and not listened to, and yet here it has come to pass. What do you think happened over that scope of time to get us to this point where it seems as though that prediction is correct?
Well, I think not necessarily harassed, but there was a little bit of suspicion that, well, maybe they were right, maybe not. And since there was no direct observations of these areas, it was very difficult to go one way or another. This really changed around the early 1990s, where we could actually observe the evolution of these glaciers from satellites for the first time. Also, some research teams ventured for the first time by ship in these areas to unravel what the ocean temperature were looking at along the coastline.
And what will be the impact of this?
Well, the impact over the long term, because as we mentioned in our reports, this is the long-term retreat of ice in West Antarctica. It's going to take a couple of centuries for all the ice to be removed from these areas. The long-term impact, of course, is sea level rise. There's enough ice to raise global sea level by a meter, four feet in this sector. But it will most likely entrain the retreat of the rest of West Antarctica, which could contribute another 10 feet of sea level rise.
And we're talking about melting that will occur over centuries, right?
It's difficult. That's a tough question. The timescales of evolution of these entities. We are at the point where we can say with reasonable certainty that this ice is going to go into the ocean. Whether it's going to take one or two centuries or three or four centuries, the jury is still a little bit out on that. The numerical models, the computer models that require to be used to do this are making progress. They're getting better at it, but they're not at the point where we can really rely on them for projection into the future.
Would you expect to see rising ocean levels that would affect coastal communities, for example, in the shorter term, maybe within our lifetimes?
Well, I think the projections for the end of this century are of a global sea level rise of about a meter. It could be a little bit more than that, a little bit less. This is not necessarily the type of number that you will see emerge from IPCC reports that form a consensus opinion based on all published literature of many years back, and also that uses numerical models that cannot quite account for all the rapid changes that are taking place in the Antarctic at present. So they inherently underestimate the contribution of these entities to sea level. 1 meter is a big deal. It will affect a large number of the coastal population around the world, millions of people. And in some places, they will be able to adapt. In some others, they will not, and they will have to move away. But the world does not end in 2100 either, and sea level rise will continue well beyond that.
Now, as I understand it, the New York Times reported that the ozone hole over Antarctica may also have been something that has played a role in this.
Yes.
How would that factor in here?
Well, a lot of the changes we're seeing in the Antarctic, they are a little bit more difficult to explain to the public than what's happening in Greenland, where you have warmer air temperature, warmer ocean, and everything melts. Nothing is melting in the Antarctic, at least not yet. Or wherever it melts, the meltwater stays in place. The changes we're seeing are associated with changes in oceanic circulation in the Antarctic, which are associated with the wind pattern, the wind regime around the Antarctic continent. And that wind regime is pretty much driven by the temperature distribution around the Earth. And in the last few decades, the rest of the world has been warming up faster than Antarctica. And the ozone has played a role in that, in keeping Antarctica cool. And the greater temperature differential between Antarctica and the rest of the world has increased the wind speed around Antarctica and allowed some of these subsurface warm water to intrude in places where they didn't used to be as much.
According to some reports, NASA called an urgent meeting on this yesterday, and you're a senior research scientist at NASA. How worried are you and your colleagues about this?
Well, it's not. This story is not really about worrying people. It's about making a stand that we reach a point in our understanding and observation of this part of Antarctica that we can say that the ice in this sector is going to retreat and continue retreat almost no matter what. Now, of course, the models clearly suggest that in a context of a warmer climate, if climate continues to warm, it is likely that the retreat of ice in that sector will proceed on a much faster pace.
Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was Eric Rigneau, professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine, and a glaciologist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab.
The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act requires that all Americans enroll in health insurance. Now, while coverage for all may be new and contentious for the country at large, the necessity of health care isn't new for many Wisconsinites with conditions that require ongoing care.
That's the case for Wisconsinites living with HIV and AIDS. HIV care requires ongoing attention from medical professionals and long-term use of antiretroviral therapy, and that need has spawned organizations around the globe that provide care to those who need it, insured or not.
One of those organizations is the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. Here to share with us how their work is changing in light of the Affordable Care Act, we have the president of the center, Michael Gifford. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And then we've got Caitlin Stahlnacher. She's Affordable Care Act specialist with the center. Caitlin, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Well, some of the people in higher risk groups for contracting HIV also in the past may have been people not likely to have health insurance or a stable home environment, sex workers, intravenous drug users. Since the AIDS crisis began, caring for those vulnerable populations has been a challenge. Now we're all required to have health insurance. Mike, let's start with you. How is that changing the work you do?
You know, the Affordable Care Act provides such great opportunity for the fight against HIV and AIDS. And at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, we're very proud of the fact that we've helped about 750 of our patients and clients enroll in health care over the course of the last 6 months or so. And what that means is really a ticket to access to care that they need for that long and healthy life, whether it's the health care we provide as the largest provider of HIV medical care in the state of Wisconsin or specialty care that they may need to access elsewhere.
And Caitlin, are there provisions in the Affordable Care Act specifically to help people with HIV?
Certainly. They've done away with extended wait periods for people with pre-existing conditions, and they've also done away with lifetime caps on claims.
And Mike, with the medications people with HIV take, they take them over the long term. How has that changed, if at all?
Well, the good news on the medication front, if we were to rewind 20 years when antiretroviral therapy first came out, it would be a handful of medications every day. And for many people with HIV and AIDS today, their HIV can be well treated with simply one pill one time a day. It's very costly. It remains at least $2,000 a month for that regimen. And that's where the Affordable Care Act can come in to help cover that incredibly high cost and free up resources for other needs that low-income people with HIV would have.
Caitlin, I know a big focus of parts of the Affordable Care Act was on preventative medicine. Are there things out there as part of the Affordable Care Act targeted at HIV prevention?
It's really just prevented, preventing healthcare symptoms coming up. There's really nothing directly related to HIV, but preventative services like yearly checkups, labs, that HIV patients are required to have very regularly, all of that is covered under the Affordable Care Act.
Go ahead, Mike.
I think that's one of the disappointments in the Affordable Care Act. Here in Wisconsin, we continue to see several hundred new HIV infections on an annual basis. We haven't seen new resources come forward to help reduce those numbers of new HIV infections in well over a decade. And that's where state and federal policy really needs to focus on if we're ever to bring about an end to the AIDS epidemic.
And for people with HIV, I know other secondary infections are often a big part of the problem. Is that the preventive care or the care provided under the Affordable Care Act, is that do you think it'll help prevent those secondary infections?
Absolutely. It's secondary infections, and it's also comorbid conditions. So people with HIV and AIDS are much more likely to struggle with issues like diabetes, neurocognitive impairment, different cancers. And we're seeing that among people with HIV maybe a generation earlier than what we would see among people with healthy immune systems. So people with in their late 40s or early 50s who are starting to address memory or have memory loss issues. And that's why the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin and our unique HIV medical home model of care is so important. All that care is provided in one location, removing many of the social barriers to successful care and treatment.
And Mike, one of the biggest controversies here in Wisconsin related to the Affordable Care Act surrounds Medicaid expansion, which the state has rejected. Does that have an impact on the work you do?
Well, certainly for anybody who post-ACA startup doesn't have health care coverage, that certainly is a barrier. We're happy that with the changes to the state Medicaid program that we were able to enroll about 400 new HIV patients into that care and treatment. And then the other important aspect here is that the state has used the Affordable Care Act and a little-known section of it, 2703, to help create a new benefit for Medicaid recipients. It's an HIV medical home benefit that provides enhanced funding for care and treatment and care coordination that will help achieve better outcomes. So we're pleased with that.
Caitlin, do you have advice for Wisconsinites with HIV or someone maybe close to them who don't currently have health insurance? They're signing up for it, or maybe they've just signed up for it. What kind of advice do you offer them?
The first thing I say is seek out community resources. ARCW is a great organization that offers many comprehensive services that address housing. There's food pantry services, transportation for people that might not be able to get to their medical appointments. Really just search out the community resources that are available to them.
And Mike, moving beyond the Affordable Care Act for a bit, I want to get a sense of the state of the art, the scope of HIV in Wisconsin, about how many people are affected by it now.
We estimate that there's about 7,000 people living with HIV in the state of Wisconsin, and that makes Wisconsin one of the low-incident states, and we're appreciative of the opportunity we've had to help contribute to that through aggressive HIV prevention for the gay community and certainly through injection drug users. But then I think we also have to acknowledge that care and treatment for people living with HIV and AIDS is critical to containing the epidemic, not only to the individual, where we can work with them to achieve a clinical outcome called an undetectable viral load. That means you're still HIV positive, but your HIV is managed as well as possible. That's good for them, but it's also good for the communities, because some studies show that people with an undetectable viral load are as much as 96% less likely to be able to transmit the disease. So treatment has become a part of the prevention focus here in Wisconsin and around the country.
And what, for you, is the biggest grounds for improvement on how we're dealing with HIV in the state?
Well, I think the nationally unique model of care that I mentioned earlier, the HIV medical home that was created under the Affordable Care Act, that integrated model of care where we have a group of professionals like social workers like Caitlin, physicians, dentists, pharmacists, mental health staff, all working together to meet the needs of HIV patients. It is very unique. It's something that I'm really proud that ARCW has been leading the country on. And we've been able to achieve a clinical outcome where 83% of our patients have an undetectable viral load. That's that magic spot where that's the best clinical outcome possible for our patients. And what's happening is that there are now organizations in 23 different states around the country that are reaching out to ARCW to learn about our model of care and how they can implement it in their states.
And Caitlin, Mike just mentioned that you're a social worker, you're working on these issues. do you see improvement over time? Are you feeling more and more optimistic about the future of people with HIV in the state?
Certainly. I mean, the integrated care model that Mike's been talking about really helps clients address the barriers that they might have to making themselves healthy and keeping them healthy. I really think that the stigma that comes along with an HIV diagnosis is also being addressed in the state of Wisconsin. So I certainly think it's improving.
I wanted to follow up on that stigma issue with you, Mike. We've been watching this, 30-plus years now. It seems like public attitudes toward HIV have really changed a lot in those decades.
You know, we have seen great progress, and in my 22 years leading ARCW, I certainly have experienced a much greater public acceptance of this disease. But then, you know, we have things like what Mr. Sterling, the owner of the Clippers, said recently, you know, that Magic Johnson should be ashamed that he's HIV positive. And unfortunately, at ARCW, one of our services that we offer is legal representation for people with HIV. And every year, there's two or three or four cases of substantial discrimination. People with HIV who are fired from their jobs because of their HIV status, not provided the health care they need because they're HIV positive, kicked out of their homes because they're HIV positive. So while I agree, Caitlin, with Caitlin's comments that it's getting better, there still is a deeply rooted, smaller part of stigma for people with HIV.
We'll leave it there. Mike, thank you so much for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you very much.
And Caitlin, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Caitlin Stalnaker and Mike Gifford. They're both with the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin.